Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Michael Beer, director of the group Nonviolence International, who assesses the escalation of violence in Syria after the Turkish military crossed the northern Syrian border and attacked U.S.-backed Kurdish rebels. Chip Burleigh, an author and researcher on racism and intolerance, who discusses recent media focus on the so-called alt-right activists leading the Trump presidential campaign and their racist belief system. And Chad Cordell of the Kanawha Forest Coalition, who talks about how the activist campaign he led succeeded in pressuring the state of West Virginia to shut down a mountaintop removal coal mine near a state forest. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During a visit by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, Nigeria's military announced that Boko Haram's vicious leader, Abubakar Shekau, had been killed in an airstrike in northeast Nigeria. This is not the first time that Shekau was reported killed by the Nigerian government, but comes at a critical time for President Buhari. For months, the Nigerian regime has requested that the Obama administration provide more military aid, including the sale of a dozen A-29 Super Tucano attack aircraft. Boko Haram, a brutal Islamist movement in West Africa, is now an affiliate of ISIS. The terrorist group came to the world's attention in 2014 after they kidnapped 280 schoolgirls in the village of Chibok. Over 200 of the girls are still missing. Over the last decade, 20,000 people have died in clashes with Boko Haram fighters. Today, Bama, the largest city that Boko Haram had held near the Cameroon border, is in shambles. The Nigerian army took control in March as thousands of people fled and widespread hunger and malnutrition set in. Even before the Nigerian airstrike targeting Abubakar Shekau, his status as Boko Haram's leader was in doubt. A new leader, Abu Masab al-Barnawi, the son of the founder of Boko Haram, emerged to challenge Shekau's position, declaring that attacks on mosques must stop, an initiative supported by ISIS's Salafist leadership. According to Foreign Policy magazine, indigenous women in Canada are four times more likely to be murdered than white women. Official statistics reveal that over 1,200 Native women were killed or have gone missing since the 1980s. This disturbing information comes at a time when Canada is dealing with its long legacy of racism against Native peoples. A shameful chapter in the nation's history includes the forced relocation of over 150,000 Native children who were sent to so-called resident schools where they were compelled to assimilate into white culture. The hostile attitudes toward Native peoples run deep in Canadian law enforcement, who have often blamed cases of missing or slain Indigenous women on drug overdoses, suicide, or runaways. In 2013, an academic paper identified 824 cases of slain or missing Indigenous women. The research prompted an official investigation by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who investigated nearly 1,200 cases of violence against Native women between 1980 and 2012. Cameron Alexis of the Assembly of First Nations called the findings a national shame and a national tragedy. When Canadians overwhelmingly elected Justin Trudeau as Prime Minister last October, one of his first acts was to announce a national inquiry into Indigenous murders. "The victims deserve justice," he told a gathering of First Nation chiefs in Gatineau, Quebec. "Their families deserve an opportunity to heal and to be heard." Young Chicago activists known as Future Fighters are visible at rallies organized by the Fight for 15 movement and Black Lives Matter. Future Fighters was launched by young members of the Service Employees International Union in Illinois and Indiana. These union activists are committed to exposing and combating income inequality, police brutality, and homelessness. Future Fighters founder LaKeisha Collins, a nursing home worker, approached an SEIU official seeking support for a new group of union members under age 35. After Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin were murdered, Collins told the publication Labor Notes, "We wanted to do more than protest in the streets, so we came up with Know Your Rights trainings." The first training attracted 70 union members, and workshops were held every few months on topics such as rights of protesters, race and class stereotyping, and the role of labor in the U.S. civil rights movement. Chandra Robinson, a co-founder of Future Fighters, recalled that discussions focused on how to de-escalate dangerous situations with law enforcement and on the long history of the judicial system working against the interests of minority groups. The movement later broadened to involve activists affiliated with Black Lives Matter in confronting police brutality. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
After a series of terrorist bomb attacks targeting police and civilians inside Turkey, and a failed coup attempt against his government, Turkey's president, Tayyip Erdogan, ordered his nation's military to invade northern Syria with the stated goal of guaranteeing his citizens' security at home and in neighboring countries. The offensive, which began on August 24th, saw Turkish tanks, artillery, and Syrian rebel allies, backed by air power, quickly capture the Syrian border town of Jarablus from Islamic State militants. But since that initial assault, Turkish forces have moved into areas controlled by fighters allied with the U.S.-backed Syrian Democratic Forces, a coalition that includes the Kurdish YPG militia that has won praise from the Obama administration for its effectiveness in battling ISIS. Clashes between Turkish-backed forces and the YPG have killed at least 25 Kurdish fighters, amid accusations that Turkey has targeted Kurdish civilians in airstrikes, a charge that Ankara denies. Washington has criticized Turkey's attack on the Kurds and is working to stop the fighting between its two allies. While Turkey favors the overthrow of the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad and opposes ISIS, President Erdogan's priority is widely believed to be preventing the establishment of a Kurdish enclave either in Syria or inside Turkey. Your reporter spoke with Michael Beer, director of the group Nonviolence International, who talks about the escalation of violence in Syria after the Turkish invasion and prospects for success in U.S.-Russian ceasefire talks taking place in Geneva.
The Turkish president Erdogan has been quite clear about his goals, if we can believe him, which I think we can. And his stated goals are that he wants to go after the ISIL, or sometimes called ISIS or Daesh group, which is the Islamic State. And he also wants to prevent the Kurds from capturing the entire Turkish-Syrian border area. And these are his two stated goals. He may have others that we don't know. But he's been attacking both ISIL groups as well as Kurdish Syria Defense Force groups. And this is an escalation of the war. Turkey, of course, has been deeply involved in providing all kinds of weaponry and political support to various actors fighting against Assad, and has shelled the border areas for a variety of reasons, usually shelling the Kurds. And this is an escalation where they've actually sent in tanks, and we don't know how long they're going to be there. President Erdogan has said in the last few days that he is there until ISIL and the Kurds are destroyed. Well, I mean, he's going to be there 1,000 years if he thinks he's going to be destroying the Kurds. So we're just not sure where this is going, other than to say that Syria now has been intervened by many, many foreign actors. And of course, the wars, there's more than one, are going to get worse as long as we have lots of outside actors who are pouring fuel on the fire.
Michael, also in the news recently has been the Russian bombing campaign in alliance with the Assad government to try to end the stalemate in one of Syria's largest cities, Aleppo, with tragic consequences. Just thousands of civilians have been killed, and that's a huge city with a civilian population now, shortage of food and medicine. Hospitals have been bombed. Russia had been using, I guess, for a short while, air bases in Iran, and then were kicked out. Lots to talk about there, but maybe we could focus on the human tragedy that has been unfolding for a long time now in Aleppo.
I thank you for focusing attention with your question about the human suffering in Syria. It's easy to get lost in this very complicated political war game of various factions and who the various external actors are, and lose sight of the fact that Syria is being ripped apart and that people are being and civilians are being killed on an enormous scale and are suffering so much. We are seeing in Aleppo an attempt by the Russians and the Assad regime and the Iranians to try to militarily win back, as they say, Aleppo. And the suffering is tremendous. They're bombing hospitals. They're bombing schools. They're starving out areas. All sides are trying to starve out areas of the other. As long as we have a lot of external actors or even internal actors that think that they can win this conflict militarily, this is unfortunately going to continue. We desperately need to have peace talks to end this fighting because there really is no military solution or victory. It may be that the Russians and the Assad regime think that they can get Aleppo back by bombing it to smithereens, and the suffering is just unbelievable. But even if they get Aleppo back, much of the country, big chunks of the country, are not under the control of the Assad regime and are not likely to be. And there just desperately needs to be talking. And unfortunately, the U.S. is the leading country in the world in terms of military power, economic power, political power. We're not really in the place to be leading talks because, frankly, we won't talk to everybody. The United States will not talk to some of the major external actors like Hezbollah. We won't talk to ISIL. We need to talk to everybody because there is no military solution. In order for this to come to conclusion, we have to get all the stakeholders at the table. Unfortunately, the U.S. is taking sides, and so we're not in the place where we can be a peacemaker, and we're helping pour a lot of fuel on this fire, unfortunately.
What are the prospects, if any, that there could be a breakthrough between Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov in talks in Geneva to arrive at some formula for a ceasefire so the killing will stop?
Well, there have been some suggestions this week that they're just not able to reach an agreement. And we're going to need sustained pressure from citizens around the world. Unfortunately, there's not much of a movement in the United States yet around this, but I think, and I'm hoping it's growing, to pressure the United States to move towards a ceasefire and a political solution in a more serious way. At the moment, I'm pessimistic that there don't seem to be on the horizon the kind of pressures that we need to get to pressure the United States and Russia to try to help make a deal as two of the leading players here.
That was Michael Beer, director of the group Nonviolence International. Learn more about the many nations supporting proxy forces engaged in Syria's civil war and prospects for peace by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The 2016 presidential election campaign, already marked by Donald Trump's blatant appeals to bigotry and finding scapegoats to blame for the nation's weak economy, sunk to a new low recently with the appointment of Steve Bannon as Trump's new campaign CEO. Bannon's rise to a top spot in mainstream U.S. politics provoked many questions, because as executive chairman of Breitbart Media, a popular right-wing website, he had cultivated a sanctuary for white supremacist, misogynist, and anti-Semitic expression. After Trump's leadership change, the media highlighted the ties between Bannon, Breitbart, and a loose network of ultra-conservative, mostly online activists known as the alt-right or alternative right. Although those associated with the alt-right movement have no officially recognized ideology, commonly held views include opposition to multiculturalism, immigration, and feminism, as well as an affinity for white nationalism, white supremacy, anti-Semitism, and nativism. Democratic Party presidential nominee Hillary Clinton responded to Bannon's leadership in the Trump campaign with a speech in Reno, Nevada, devoted to denouncing Trump's divisive rhetoric, appealing to the emerging racist ideology known as the alt-right, and warned that a nationalist conservative fringe had taken over the Republican Party. Your reporter spoke with Chip Berlay, an investigative journalist, research analyst, scholar, and activist, who has written about racism and intolerance for over four decades. Here he examines the belief system of the alt-right and the significance of their presence in the upper echelon of the Republican Party in mainstream U.S. politics.
There's a lot of baloney that's pretty smelly coming out of this crowd, and whether or not they really want to adopt the pseudoscientific racist and anti-Semitic theories of Hitler's Nazi Germany is a debatable point. Some do, some don't. It's a very diffuse network. There are people who think that an ethno-nationalist state has to share a particular religion or lack of religion. There are people who view themselves as libertarian or right-wing anarchists, while others call themselves true conservatives, the real conservatives, going back to, you know, a period of writing about conservatism in Germany in the 20s and 30s. So it's very complicated, but it is oddly quite intellectual among the ideologues. But a lot of the men who adopt it, and it's mostly men, are really aggressive thugs and jerks. And they're not just anti-feminist, they're misogynist, they're not just anti-gay, but they're horrifically homophobic. And so, you know, it's not the research I enjoy doing.
Chip, tell us about Stephen Bannon, the executive chairman of Breitbart Media, who's now moved over to be the CEO of the Trump campaign. What is his connection, directly or indirectly, with this alt-right movement?
Well, he basically beats the drum for them. He, I think, is a political operative that is quite loathsome. One of the things that I think is really horrifying is that he basically comes out of a kind of working class background and got involved in, you know, working in these circles and made a documentary about, you know, Ronald Reagan facing down evil. And Breitbart News, of course, he became, you know, the chair of the Breitbart News company, the parent company, and Breitbart himself was a vicious rumor monger and personality attacker, basically became a very influential political news media person, but yet he identifies as a conservative. He defined himself as essentially anti-establishment and talks about the, you know, global political elites who run everything. So it's kind of hard to pin some of these folks down, but for Trump to make anyone connected with Breitbart, especially someone who is so high up in the organization, Breitbart, of course, is now dead, but there's still a Breitbart News kind of circulation stuff going on. So it's horrible that this is now considered part of the political discussion for a leading candidate in America for the presidency.
If you were to distinguish the differences between the alt-right movement and more explicitly racist groups like the KKK and neo-Nazis, what, if any, is that difference?
No, they wear better suits and they know which fork to use at the dinner table.
All right. I think that puts it squarely in plain language. Yeah, we got it. Thank you, Chip.
What can I say? It's the same basic ideology. It's just whether or not it's presented on a platter or in a paper, you know, dish.
Chip, what in your mind is the significance of the presence of some adherence to this alt-right philosophy at the highest levels of the Trump for President campaign. What does it mean for the Republicans, and what does it mean for mainstream U.S. politics?
The United States political system has already been pushed very far to the right, historically, from the time of the Taft and the anti-union, anti-big government move, all the way before the election of Roosevelt. So we're already pushed way to the right. Now we have introduced into the political system a theory which led to the murder of millions in Europe. So, you know, we should take that seriously. We're being pushed now to accept as a legitimate or at least active and effective political ideology basically an idea that we're going to have to get rid of a huge sector of our population physically by expulsion. And arguably, if some have said openly in the alt-right network that if the people don't leave, they'll be forced to leave or they'll be killed.
That was Chip Berlay, an investigative journalist, research analyst, scholar, and activist who has written about racism and intolerance for over four decades. Learn more about the links between the alt-right movement, racism, and the Trump campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection hardly ever turns down a permit application for companies seeking to conduct mountaintop removal coal mining. That's the extraction process in which a company literally blows the top off of a mountain ridge to mine the coal seams beneath. Debris is often dumped into the valleys below, which thus far has smothered more than 1,500 miles of streams. But West Virginia's DEP recently signed an unprecedented consent decree with Keystone Development, a subsidiary of the Florida-based Keystone Industries, to permanently stop mountaintop removal mining at the KD No. 2 strip mine located on the outskirts of Charleston, West Virginia's capital. The site is adjacent to a state forest, popular with residents for hiking and other recreational activities. The mine was initially approved by the DEP in May 2014 for strip mining and the explosive blasting within 600 feet of the Kanawha State Forest and within 1,500 feet of homes in the nearby Holler. The Kanawha Forest Coalition was formed by local residents early in 2014 to protect their community from the impacts of the 413-acre KD No. 2 mine. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus recently visited West Virginia and attended the coalition's victory rally on August 23rd. Here, coalition coordinator Chad Cordell traces the history of the successful campaign to close down the mine.
In the first year after the permit was issued, approximately 100 acres out of the total 413-acre permit area was stripped of trees and partially mined. Mining has been temporarily suspended since about early 2015. So at this point, three-fourths of the permit area has not been disturbed, has not been mined. Yes. And we are here today after over 2 years of work by the Kanawha Forest Coalition to announce that the DEP has finally ordered a permanent stop to the mining at the KD No. 2 mine. This is a powerful demonstration of the impact that citizens can have when we take a stand, we stay persistent, and we don't back down. Many people thought that this mine was unstoppable after the permit was issued, but we doubled down. We gathered over 5,000 signatures on a petition to demand that the permit be revoked. We held community meetings throughout Charleston and in Loudoundale, attended by hundreds of people. We held rallies here at the Capitol and at the DEP. We monitored the water quality coming from the mine site on a weekly basis. We met consistently with the DEP and even met once with Keystone Industries owner Tom Scholl, who lives in Florida and who, after refusing to meet with us for months, We happened to spot at a downtown Charleston restaurant when he was in town, and we sat down with him for an impromptu meeting. During that meeting, we asked Tom Scholl about the pollution coming off his mines, and he told us that the DEP would fix the water. In other words, Tom Scholl expects the citizens of West Virginia to clean up his mess. Unfortunately, the legal framework that allows for strip mining to persist is built on a mountain of false assumptions. And to look at the actual conditions on the ground, like we have, and not just the assumptions that are made on paper when these applications are put in, means having to accept that strip mining and mountaintop removal simply cannot be done without irreparable harm to our land, our water, and our health. It's up to us, as a community, to continue tearing down the coal industry's mountain of lies just as effectively as they've torn down the mountains of our homeland. With this order, the DEP has taken a step toward addressing the many issues at the KD No. 2 mine. But these aren't isolated issues. These are widespread problems, and they are inherent in the process of strip mining. This campaign was never about just stopping this one mine. It's about shining a bright light on the issue of strip mining and showing just how damaging it really is. Many other communities in West Virginia are being harmed by surface mining and mountaintop removal. The DEP website currently lists over 20 pending surface mine applications in West Virginia, including the Long Ridge No. 2 and the Center Contour mines, which are being actively opposed right now by our friends at the Coal River Mountain Watch in Raleigh County, West Virginia. The Kanawha Forest Coalition strongly urges the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection to deny these permits that will inevitably lead to the same sorts of issues we've seen on the KD No. 2 mine. I'd like to wrap up with a quote from the late West Virginia organizer, Don West, who said, "The abuse of the land always goes hand in hand with the abuse of the people. Always. We've stopped the abuse of the land in this one little area next to Kanawha State Forest, but it's long past time that we stopped the abuse of our land and people across West Virginia."
That was Chad Cordell, coordinator of the Kanawha Forest Coalition. Learn more about the group in growing opposition to mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.